Pachinko is a deeply intimate yet hugely expansive multi-generational historical saga on Apple TV+. The series features several intersecting characters and storylines, but focuses mainly on Sunja, a Korean woman whose family suffers under Japanese imperial rule amid conditions of poverty, bigotry, and institutionalized injustice against Koreans. I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about Pachinko on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining us today is Kristen Meinzer. She is the co-host of the podcast Movie Therapy with Rafer and Kristen. She's also the author of How to Be Fine. Welcome back, Kristen.
So glad to be back, Glenn.
Glad to have you. Also joining us is Ingu Kang. She's the TV critic at the Washington Post. Welcome back, Ingu.
Hi.
Hi. And rounding out our fantastic Murderers Row panel is writer and film critic Laura Sirikul. Welcome back, Laura.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. Let's get into this. Pachinko is an 8-episode series based on the 2017 novel of the same name by Min Jin Lee. The series follows one Korean family from the early part of the 20th century through the 1980s as they endure Japanese oppression both in Korea and in Japan. It's a story of generational trauma marked by fleeting moments of triumph, and it largely revolves around the character of Sunja. As in the book, the series depicts Sunja in three different time periods. First, when she's a young girl in a tiny fishing village outside Busan, when she's played by Yuna Jeon. Later, newcomer Min Ha Kim plays Sunja as a young woman when she marries a pastor and tries to make a life for herself and her family in Japan. And we also see Sunja as an old woman, still living in Japan, just as her long-held ability to bury the traumas of her past finally begins to crumble. There she's played by the legendary Yeo Jung-yoon, who won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar for Minari. The cast also features K-drama superstar Lee Min-ho as a rich fish broker slash gangster who takes an interest in Sunja, and Steve Zhang-hyun-no as a sickly pastor who falls in love with her. Jin-ha plays Solomon, Sunja's grandson, a banker who's forced to reckon with the enduring legacy of Japan's mistreatment of Korean people in a surprising way. The series was created by Soo Hyu, and half of the episodes were directed by Koga Nada, the filmmaker behind Columbus and After Yang, which we talked about on this show, and the other half by Justin Chon. We should note that the series does not cover the entirety of the novel, as creator Soo Hyu has said she envisions the series having 4 seasons, and at this taping, a second season hasn't yet been announced. Kristen, what'd you think of Pachinko?
I was so excited. So before the series even came out, I was pumped for this. I read the book. It was the first book I read at the beginning of the pandemic during lockdown. As a Korean-American adoptee, it taught me certain things about Korean history that I didn't know. And I just loved this book so much. And so I was very excited about the series. Now, the reason I'm telling you all this up front is because my expectations were already very high. Mm-hmm. But the series itself, it does deliver on some of my expectations. It is very beautiful to look at. It is both epic and intimate, as you said. The acting is fantastic. And I devoured every single episode over the course of, I think, 2.5 or 3 days. So I did enjoy it quite a bit. But I will say that I did not think it was perfect. I think that the decision to jump around in time quite a bit rather than spend as much time as we should have with our main character, Sunja, was a flaw. I'll also say that there are some side characters that I wish we would have spent less time with.
Interesting. And I've heard that critique before from other folks, folks like Ingu Kang. Ingu, what'd you think?
Wow. Where do I start? Pachinko is maybe one of my 2 favorite books that I've read of the past decade, the other one being Americana. Uh-huh. It is a book that means an enormous amount to me, and I think I kind of had the opposite reaction as Kristen when I heard there was going to be an adaptation, which is that I thought, there's no way they can do this book justice. From a TV critic perspective, it is a weird, weird choice for a TV adaptation. It is mostly in Korea and Japan. It concerns a lot of Korean and Japanese history that Americans do not really know very much about. It takes place in 3 countries. It's in 3 languages. But I will say that the parts of the show that I preferred were the parts where they really took a departure from the book. Kristen already mentioned that she didn't like the fact that they jumped around in time instead of going chronologically as in the book. For me, that was honestly probably the best thing that they could have done. I was really skeptical that an American audience would sit in for a TV show that took place in the 1910s in Korea under Japanese occupation. And I feel like I was right. They were like, no, let's like bring in a guy who sort of like has a connection to America in some way for the American audience. But it really reminded me of Greta Gerwig's adaptation of Little Women, in that right. by cross-cutting these storylines, you really get a sense of like how the past has affected the future and how the future sort of like lines up or doesn't line up with the past. And so I have to say that the further it gets away from the book, the more it just sort of helped me feel like it was something new that it was bringing, as opposed to just sort of a dramatization of stuff that happened that I already read about.
Interesting, interesting. Laura, what about you?
So I, like when I first heard, I was so excited because I trusted the, like Sue and her, you know, her previous work, you know, with the terror and they're incorporating a lot of, Korean artists and Korean American artists involved. So I was like, I trusted the vision that they had. Minjin like also, you know, signed off on it. So I was like, okay, I trust her. Like her book is one of the best books I've read in the past decade. And I was so excited when I heard that it was going to be made. Watching it though, I did enjoy the reflection of like the past and the present. The only thing I had issues with is that I felt like it was a little bit westernized. Uh-huh. It's a Korean story. But I felt like the series kind of gave it a westernized feel to it regarding the storytelling and the conclusion, like kind of trying to make the character more a hero instead of what he is, like in, from the book. And I felt like it just didn't follow the source material regarding the themes, other than the themes of generational trauma and everything and family. But I really enjoyed the story. And like Ingu said, like when they didn't follow the book, I really, really enjoyed that aspect. But I don't know. I think I'm so in love with the book that it was hard for me to separate that, you know, like, because I love this book so much. But it just felt like more westernized than what the book was trying to give.
Interesting. I'm fascinated by the different takes on the fact that the show interweaves these storylines, because I did not read the book, but I ate this thing up with a big old spoon. I think it's incredibly immersive experience, as you guys mentioned. The performances are so good. The performances are really intimate, yet expressive when they need to be. There's, of course, an outer stoicism that these performances manage to push past without being, you know, didactic or over the top. It's, I really admire the storytelling and the filmmaking. There are throughout, however, moments where characters experience, I guess you'd call them epiphanies, like kinds of emotional insights or a sudden realization of their place in history, certain truths about the world. Those are the kind of moments that prose novels are built upon, because the author can avail themselves of so many different methods to convey them to the reader. And here, when it's expressed through dialogue alone, they can come off as a bit overdetermined, a bit forced, a bit overwritten. And I have to acknowledge some of that nuance could literally be getting lost in translation.
For what it's worth, I felt like there was like a big quality difference in the dialogue in as it's spoken in Korean versus what the English subtitles are. I always felt like the Korean dialogue was better.
Yeah, that's maybe what I'm picking up on. But we've all kind of talked around this one subplot, so let's go full in. Let's talk about the Hana storyline. She is the daughter of Solomon's dad's girlfriend, and she's a sex worker who contracts AIDS. That subplot, to me, was serving up some serious manic pixie dream girl meets Forrest Gump in a way that was a lot more moralistic and heavy-handed than the stuff around it, right?
Yeah. And I hated that character in the book, too.
Interesting.
And I cannot believe that the series chose to spend so much time on this character, who was, in my opinion, not just the weakest part of the book, but in the book was, I think, trying to hand lessons to us that we didn't need handed to us. We already know the lessons that generational trauma is real, that it comes out in different ways, that some of us are going to be self-destructive, that some of us are going to be nihilistic and so on. Mm-hmm. And we don't need it hammered so hard home in the book or in the TV series. And I feel that the TV series spent even more time with her than the book. And, oh, she's just maddening. And it's just too much. It's a hammer where all you need is a little tap on the shoulder.
For me, the Hana storyline just was sort of like to try to give Solomon something extra to sort of like justify his screen time. And it really did not work. And I think also it was trying really hard to like capture something of the moment. It's the 80s and people are more sexually liberated than they were before. Certainly that has a huge contrast with the way that Sunjak grew up in provincial Korea. And so I understand that they were trying to do something with this sense of historical sweep. And yet I think it just sort of felt a little bit on the nose and that's sort of like, well, it's the 80s. So like, what storyline can we have here?
That's right. Big hair, shoulder pads, and AIDS. Yeah. There is a greater emphasis on Solomon's storyline, at least in this season. Maybe in subsequent seasons there won't be. But like in this season, you've all touched on this. And something that Shirley Lee in The Atlantic mentioned is that she feels that that greater emphasis is evidence that the show doesn't trust the audience to be sufficiently interested in Sunja's life. And so by having us see her through his eyes, it's turning the story of her life into a very conventional generational clash, culture clash. Is that a fair critique?
I do agree. Like the showrunner has an idea of, you know, the several seasons. And I think they're just trying to get your attention on like how it affects Solomon. Mm-hmm. I feel like people are so focused on the westernized aspect of it. And I think that's my biggest problem with this is that I love the series. I love what the themes were. But I think they were focusing so much on the western side of it that that's why Solomon's story was so focused. And like Sunja, we get this beautiful story, but like the whole storyline has a western thing to it, and it's not how the story plays out in the book.
I felt like one of the stronger elements that the TV show really leaned into was its sort of like aura of diaspora blues, like the sense that you don't really fit in back where you came from or where you grew up. I think one of the storylines I like the most very early on in the show is when you can sort of tell that Solomon, by growing up in Japan and facing a lot of discrimination there, goes to New York. And of course, I think from the vantage point of 22, it's a little funny that like, go to America, there's no Asian hate there. But this sort of idea that if you become rich enough that you can sort of like outrun race or ethnicity or discrimination, I think that's a really interesting and also very common idea. The contrast between the grandmother and the grandson is really fascinating here, because with the grandmother, she basically moves to Japan so she can actually continue surviving. And it's sort of only much later that she realizes that she has essentially forsaken forever this sort of like sense of home. And it's really interesting that she does so under these conditions of poverty. And with her grandson, when he flees to New York, it is very much a sense of like this idea that like you can have social mobility, and through that you can almost like buy your way out of having to have a sense of home. I think like all of that stuff is really fascinating. I just think that, you know, with Solomon, that storyline kind of ends where he realizes, actually, like, you do need to have a sense of home. Actually, you do need to have a sense of cultural groundedness. And then it has sort of like nowhere to go. And that's when we get Hana, which isn't Hana's fault, but that's sort of like where we end up.
No, I do agree with you on that. I love the themes of sacrifice and the burden. Like there's one scene where Solomon, the elderly Korean lady, tells Solomon like, you know, what family hasn't suffered? And, you know, tell me the truth. When old people talk about suffering, isn't it tiresome?
Such a good line.
I felt like I got punched in the face with like from hearing like my family history and stuff. And he responds with a straight face. Isn't that the point? To burden us. And I just felt like that with my heart and soul. And yes, it is part of the diaspora and westernized. But that's what I loved about that, because we can reflect that no matter where you are, even if you're not part of the diaspora, it's the burden of generational burden and generational sacrifice and trauma that we always face. My thing was mainly of, you know, Solomon is like more of the hero type. Hana, we have to give them some kind of hero or happy ending kind of situation, even though, you know, that's not a happy ending for her, but it's we give them a happy story. And I feel like that's a westernized thing.
I think that sort of happy ending thing that you're talking about is part of like a really big frustration I have with this TV series, and that I think the more it sort of dives into alienation and melancholy and trauma, you know, like all of the really fun stuff, it's really, really good. But then there's this like weird undercurrent of uplift and inspiration that it's also trying to do. And every time the show sort of like goads me, sort of like pokes me into like, this is where you're supposed to feel really inspired. I just rebel against the show. I don't really need to be told that people who endured something much more than me, like, are admirable. I already know this. And the fact that, like, it sort of tries to put on this, like, overlay of you also have to feel good in addition to feeling sad, it just really drove me nuts and really felt false and artificial.
Yeah, and that's not just an overlay, Inku. Mm-hmm. I didn't need that. You know the old rule, show, don't tell?
Yeah.
But you don't need to tell me everything. Some of the stuff is going to come through in the story, and it doesn't need to be a constant. Yes.
Right. But here's my theory. So the symbolism of the game of pachinko, which if you don't know is a game of chance that has a pinball-like quality, that is apparently very central to the book. It's not as central to the series, but it does seem to reflect the theme that emerges, which is what I admire is how deeply unsentimental and pragmatic it is, which is life is unfair, you know, injustice, inequality, punishing loss, suffering are fixtures of your life because the universe, like the owners of pachinko parlors, fix the game against you. The number of times somebody in this show is told to stop feeling sorry for themselves, I lost count after like 16. But let's talk about those opening credits, though, which, I mean, every time the skip intro button came up, I would be like, oh, as if I'm going to skip this. What are you, crazy? The main characters are dancing in a pachinko parlor, and they're not just dancing to any song. They are dancing to a song by the Grassroots called Let's Live for Today, which is a song that says, implicitly and explicitly, don't worry about the future, let's just love each other.
May others plan the future, I'm busy loving you. 1, 2, 3, 4, sha-la-la-la-la-la, live for today.
Which is such a more joyous and also a lot more simplistic vibe than the series that follows it is giving off. There's always kind of a low-level narrative whiplash that happens once the episode starts, because you're going from that joyousness to misery or suffering. That dissonance, do you think some of that dissonance might be what y'all are talking about?
I loved those opening credits. I'm just like you, Glenn. I would like occasionally rewind them and watch them again because I loved them so much. They're candy-colored. They're mm-hmm. beautiful. You know, all the characters, good or bad, are dancing, and it's so fun to watch. Mm-hmm. It did make me think every time I watched those opening credits, live for today, the idea of that is something that people have to do if they're living in a war zone. It's what people have to do if they're living hand to mouth or paycheck to paycheck, right? We have to live for today. Are we really going to create a 401k right now or think about our retirement plans when we don't have enough to eat? So in a way, it seems joyous, but you know, when I at least scratch the surface, I'm like, oh, that's so sad. And so it may be joyous, but, and of course I dance to it, but, you know, beneath it, people who only have the choice to live for today aren't normally in the best situations.
It sort of has like a little bit of that feel of like The Favorite, mm-hmm. Where people are in period dress and then they're in this like very 80s style pachinko parlor. And obviously mm-hmm. all of the dance moves are from right now. And so you get this like really beautiful anachronism, which I think sort of is really fun because it collapses all of these different timelines that we have been talking about into like this one setting and also yeah. goes back to the sense of like, we are all connected. We are all the same. This is like one bloodline and everyone is like, yeah, it doesn't sort of like totally work. But I mean, who doesn't want to watch a bunch of like people in pure misery just like dance it out for 10 seconds.
Yeah.
I don't know how Kristen and Laura feel about this. I really felt watching this, I think especially as like a Korean American, one of the reasons why that sort of like uplift or like the inspiration stuff really grated on me is that it felt like a show that was like very reticent to portray the full horrors of war and colonialism. And I think it sort of had to be because if you are just going to watch people being slaughtered left and right, you are really not going to care about 16-year-old Sunja's like, mm-hmm. you know, like romantic travails and like the love triangle that she's in. And I understand that choice coming from that angle, but you know, it was genuinely a little bit jarring to see war and colonialism and, you know, what we're essentially describing in terms of, like, the Japanese occupation of Korea ended up being, you know, like this, like, really strenuous effort at a kind of cultural annihilation. It was very strange to focus so much on the endurance, focus so much on the resilience. There is almost like no sense of like grief for what the rest of the country is going through. On the one hand, I understand that like this is not that story, but on the other hand, this is a lot of people's only exposure to this history. And so the fact that like the history is so soft-pedaled really sort of like rubbed me the wrong way. I just sort of like wanted to put that out there because I feel like if you also aren't already familiar with this history, you probably do not have a sense of like the absolute brutality of it. Mm-hmm. It bummed me out.
Well, I think that some of that may have been dealt with better if how they jumped around in time was done differently. We skipped, for the most part, over an entire generation that we don't really get to see and those traumas. And then suddenly we have Solomon in the present day, whose traumas compared to his grandmother's are so completely different and about America mostly, right? Mm-hmm. And that was really one of my biggest issues with how the show jumped around in time. It jumped to the wrong places, in my opinion, at times. And then it would tell, not show. Like, I wanted that shown to me, and I wanted to see how all of the intricacies and pain of being born to somebody who didn't want to be in Japan, who had to go to Japan. What did her kids go through? Mm-hmm. Because of skipping major parts of the middle, I feel like we missed out on some of that.
I think one of the things that really spoke to me about the book and something that like the TV show captures very intermittently is this sort of idea that you don't really have a really strong understanding of what your parents or your grandparents went through to bring you into what is either like the promised land or like the land where like you won't die, let's say. At the same time as like sort of like being in this extremely privileged position of almost not having to understand all of the sacrifices that they went through, being overwhelmed by the burden of having to make sure that those sacrifices were worth something, that you've sort of like made good on the sacrifices that of the older generation. Mm-hmm. I thought all of that was really conveyed beautifully. And, you know, like, is that a quote unquote, like westernized storyline? I don't know. It's certainly very relatable to, I think, a lot of people in the West because of its aspect of like the melancholy of diaspora. And I think it was sort of nice for me to see that like, oh, this is a thing that like I am deeply familiar with. And also these other Korean people over in Japan mm-hmm. can also feel this. And we are all connected.
Well, I mean, we also have to keep in mind that if creator Soo-hyu has her way, she'll get three more bites of the apple. Maybe some of the critiques we're talking about today will get addressed. Maybe they won't. It's tough to say. But in the meantime, tell us what you think about Pachinko. I'm sure you have thoughts. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Up next, what is making us happy this week? Now it's time for our favorite segment of This Week and Every Week. What is making us happy this week? Kristen, what is making you happy this week?
Oh my gosh. Julia on HBO Max is making me so happy. I am loving it. This is a miniseries following Julia Child's rise from cookbook author to TV personality. It just shows her and her marriage in a light that I haven't seen before. We see her frustrations, her insecurities, her ambition, her swearing, all of that is front and center. And I just have to say, it's also a feast for the eyes. It's got those colorful 1960s sets and costumes. The cast is terrific. I just cannot say enough good things about Julia on HBO Max. That's what's making me happy this week.
Great pick. That's Julia on HBO Max. Ingu, what is making you happy this week?
I'm going to go with Gerard Carmichael's Rothaniel, which is his latest stand-up special for HBO. It is his third. He comes out as gay, as you might have heard. And what I really love about this stand-up special is that it is a complete 180 from the Carmichael show. He leaves himself exposed in a way that I have just like never seen from him or really from most other comedians. I love the way that he talks about his coming out process because I feel like in a lot of pop culture, we treat it like a sort of like one and done. You have like the dining room table conversation with your parents and then you sort of like move on. And that is not Carmichael's story. And especially as a 34-year-old coming out, you know, that adds like a whole nother level of complication. And I just found it so lovely and so breathtakingly honest. And I think that director Bo Burnham also just adds a lot of really interesting visual departures from what we generally expect of stand-up specials. Roth Anio, go watch it.
Thank you, Ingu Kang. That's another great pick. We've actually had episodes about both Julia and Rathaniel this week, so you can check them out. Laura Sirical, what is making you happy this week?
Everyone needs to watch Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Mm-hmm. It is one of the best movies I've seen, like maybe ever for me. And it talks about family, about motherhood, love, and, you know, the existentialism, you know, nihilism, and, you know, nothing matters, but it does. And it makes you realize the important things in your life. And just, it made me laugh, cry, and angry, and just feel every emotion that I could ever feel in my life. So that definitely highly recommend. That made me so happy. And I've watched it maybe like 3 times already. And then my second thing is BTS concerts. Mm-hmm. They've taken over Las Vegas. So I'm covering it. And that is making me really happy to be able to see them and experience this in Vegas.
That's fantastic. That's the phenomenon that is BTS and the movie Everything, Everywhere, All at Once by the Daniels, which is in theaters now. A movie I'm looking forward to so much that I haven't yet listened to the PCHH episode about it because I want to go in as clean, as fresh as possible. Thank you so much, Laura. What is making me happy this week is the comedy series Our Flag Means Death on HBO Max. This series is fantastic. It's just, you know, imagine the sensibility of What We Do in the Shadows and Wellington Paranormal brought to the genre that is swashbuckling pirate. It's not a mockumentary, of course, but it is that whole Taika Waititi schmear. It's also based on a true story, which is maybe the weirdest thing about this wonderfully weird show. Rhys Darby finally gets the top billing, the spotlight that he's always deserved. He plays gentleman pirate Steed Bonnet, who is actually a real person, who actually did meet up with Blackbeard, who is here played by Taika Waititi. This show knows exactly the vibe it's going for and nails it from the jump. It is so assured and so smart, and not for nothing, and this does kind of emerge over the course of the series, it is deeply queer. And so it gets my highest recommendation. That is Our Flag Means Death on HBO Max.
A show literally made for Glenn.
It's totally, totally engineered in an underground lab somewhere in the Midwest for the me's of the world. That brings us to the end of our show. Kristen Meinzer, Ingu Kang, Laura Sirikul, thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you've got a minute and you're so inclined, please sign up for our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. This episode was produced by Candace Lim and edited by Jessica Reedy and Mike Katziff. And Hello Come In provides the music that you are hearing right now. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we will see you all next week.